Gnishtish ha iadi, gnishtish ha vaid kwani, hatu yek e yi ani kach watu a adi. Ach tu asiku gnishtish e daya haka, gnishtish trupna chadi, shuka chadi, deshi tan. Ganach adi ka ganach tedi, gnishtish.
Gnishtish ka guantan, gnishtish sa gwedi, ka shangu kedi.
Ida y duasa, yeshnach siti, ganach tedi awe, jishkat kwan, ka akwasasane kwan, mohak dachchen.
Yet tutin y duasa, chach nach siti, zagwedi ka kik kwan awe. Gishchish.
We just wanted to thank you all for coming and acknowledge the Hawaiian people for allowing us to be on their land, as well as thanking some of the Tlingit clans that have been our teachers and have supported us on our language learning journey. Gnishtish.
So the goal of our discussion is meant to contribute to and further dialogue about the role and responsibility of second language learners who do not have ancestral heritage of the indigenous languages that they're learning. While little research has been completed on this particular subject, we feel it's a necessary topic of inquiry as public access to language learning opportunities increase. We understand that categorization is problematic, and the intention is not to set up a dichotomy between heritage versus non-heritage language learners, as these categories are themselves fluid and incredibly diverse. Instead, we use these labels pretty loosely to respect different language learner experiences and represent those experiences while recognizing that each individual and each community will set up these distinctions differently. Language endangerment, as everybody knows in this room, is a global phenomena. Tlingit is in, as is the case with most indigenous North American languages, is currently combating severe language loss. It's spoken in Southeast Alaska, the Yukon, and Northern BC, and is a branch of the Na Dene Athabascan language family. This is a map here of traditional Tlingit country. It's not super legible, but you get the idea that it goes up into parts of Canada, and then this is the Southeast Alaskan panhandle here. Each community confronting language loss faces myriad obstacles in the creation of new speakers that are globally related yet singular to that local language. A campaign of discrimination towards people and their language is typically the catalyst for a break in generational trauma of the language. The United States' history and long history in particular of settler colonialism, and in the Tlingit context in particular, the genocidal campaign of the residential and boarding school systems can account for the deterioration of language health on Tlingit Ani, Tlingit land. As a perpetuation of the Manifest Destiny movement, an atmosphere of settler colonialism continues to thrive in the state of Alaska, commonly referred to as the Last Frontier. Alaska's history is often summarized by the gold rush, rich fisheries, and oil, myths emphasizing unowned wealth in an unclaimed land. March 30th, 2017 marks the 150th anniversary of the Treaty of Sessions, through which Russia sold land that it did not own, in most cases even occupy, to the United States of America. In this short window of time, the Tlingit-speaking population has been reduced to less than 110 speakers, and that includes all language level fluencies, so first year learners all the way through fluent burst speakers. Tlingit is a well-documented language, with the most extensive and celebrated work of documentation coming from renowned scholars Kehune Nora Marks Downhauer and her late husband Kwainok Richard Downhauer. While there has been an increase in Tlingit people doing language documentation, pedagogy, and maintenance of their language, there still exists a disproportionate power dynamic between language research and documentation and community usability and language goals. Batiste and Henderson writes, researchers must seek methodologies that build synthesis without relying on negative exclusions or on a strategy of differences. Nowhere is this work more needed than in the universities. These academic disciplines have been drawn from a Eurocentric canon that supports production-driven research while exploiting indigenous peoples, their languages, and their heritage. The expert title of the researcher granted by universities, for example, has been and can still be used to silence the often unquestioned historical exploitation of Native peoples, their cultures, and their lands in the creation of such institutions. Both myself and Yet Two Teens started learning Tlingit at the University of Alaska Southeast, and so our shared experience has been in an environment that has historical baggage to manage in relation to Indigenous peoples and Indigenous languages especially. As a master's student in linguistics and soon to be a PhD student in anthropology, most of my relationship with Tlingit, language revitalization, and language learning has been through academia. This is not to disparage my past or current university affiliations, but instead a recognition of the privilege of being educated and the acknowledgement that that educational system is a flawed one. While I also have the privilege of being brought in and adopted by the Tlingit community, I am situated in conflicting positions of being ancestrally Mohawk as well as a researcher working with the Tlingit language.
Similarly, my role in learning Tlingit shares the outsider space of the linguist. I'm a non-heritage learner of Tlingit, and I began my study by enrolling in a beginning Tlingit course. And while all of my teachers have been Tlingit, this doesn't change the fact that I am a white woman studying an Indigenous language, and I gained this privilege in the context of the university. In a sense where heritage language learners have generational and familial ties to the language, my motivation comes from a sense of place growing up in Occoquan territory. Like Ida, I have also been adopted and brought into a Tlingit clan. I'm currently working for an Alaska Native-run nonprofit as part of a team to develop curriculum and support Tlingit language instruction in the Juneau School District. Simultaneously, I'm working on a self-directed master's degree program at Alaska Pacific University with a focus on Tlingit language revitalization. Despite the contingency of our varying backgrounds, the Dauenhauers remind us that all of us now inherit the legacy of this unpleasant and even genocidal history. One component of which is that the native languages of Southeast Alaska are on the verge of extinction. Contextualizing language revitalization in the concrete history of the last century and a half, it becomes clear that my own involvement with the language long preceded my conscious attempt at learning to speak it. While I grew up in Juneau, the traumatic silence concerning the shared history of our town served to keep the divisions and antagonisms over language strong, long past the formal halting of segregated assimilationist schools in 1954. Paul Berg, an educator and Alaska Native language advocate, affirms that segregation structures curriculum and outlives the apparent integration of schools. In his 5 essays printed by the local newspaper, the Juneau Empire, he references the findings of the Indian Nations at Risk Task Force, which states the absence of Indigenous culture and language from the curriculum of schools serving predominantly Native American students is the primary obstacle to student achievement. A personal result of this absence of Tlingit content is that after attending public school from 1996 to 2008, so when I started kindergarten to graduating high school, the extent of my knowledge was the ability to recognize and mispronounce one Tlingit word and be familiar with one censored raven story. Segregation at the level of curriculum is but one extension of the segregation inherent in the historical process of settler colonization, affecting not only educational systems, but the larger community of Southeast Alaska in its totality. While I'm not a linguist traveling to unfamiliar territory, my experience learning Tlingit has felt like the experience of an outsider in the sense that I had a complete lack of knowledge in cultural customs, intricate clan relations, and historical Tlingit figures leading the fight for social justice in Tlingit Ani. The study of the language initiated a process of critically defamiliarizing the settler territory. The same material space presented itself with a radically different historical significance. As a part of this outsider domain, I was unprepared for what Shaw refers to as the duality of loss, which encompassed both language loss and the disruptive psychological consequences of loss. She argues that a deeper understanding of these realms of loss is important for the outsider as well as the community in achieving success in language documentation. In her book on intergenerational and historical trauma, Haunting Legacies, Gabrielle Schwab writes, "Remaining frozen in guilt not only sustains a culture of silence, but also induces defenses that prevent working through the past. Understood in this way, mourning is not a melancholic attachment to injury, but on the contrary, prepares the ground for a future-oriented integration of the past. The perpetrators of colonial violence in Alaska remain largely frozen in guilt, explaining the silenced histories, segregated curriculums and communities, and continued language shift. As a response to the silence, Schwab suggests that descendants of victims, as well as descendants of perpetrators, must act in order to escape their mutual isolation and begin talking about their different traumatic histories together. What language is used to break this silence?
Schwab reminds us that linguistics is not a neutral study, and while doing research in contradiction with the wishes of a language community is clearly counterproductive for successful revitalization, working with the expressed goals and desires of a language community does not solidify a future of language restoration and vitality. Schwab quotes the Dauenhauers, where they soberly note that if no action is taken, language death is imminent, but that action alone may not reverse language shift. The authors do the difficult introspective work of recognizing existing language ideologies for Tlingit. They are critical of their own role in language revitalization, saying, "We have contributed to the failures as well as the successes in the general language restoration effort of the last quarter century." This kind of honest reflection is crucial in the work to create more Tlingit speakers, especially as language learning pathways continue to be sculpted. Kroskerty, and I apologize if that is not the correct pronunciation of that last name, builds on the work of the Dauenhauers by intricately defining language ideological clarification as the process of identifying issues of language ideological contestation within a heritage language community, including both beliefs and feelings that are indigenous to that community and those introduced by outsiders that can negatively impact community efforts to successfully engage in language maintenance and renewal. Unpacking this definition, we see that language ideologies, as with language survival, have internal and external forces, internal to the heritage language community and introduced from external social forces. Again, these factors outside of the heritage language community cannot alone save a language or condemn it, but it will serve to influence it regardless of the policy. Identifying outside of the heritage language community does not imply a lack of language ideology on part of the researcher or a government official or a language learner. Reading this definition as such perpetuates the concept of the researcher as a neutral observer. The more challenging approach involves the introspective work of analyzing the biases the researcher is bringing to the community they are working with. In terms of non-heritage language learners, it may be doubly necessary to consider prior ideological clarification in relation to language revitalization efforts. First, between the researcher and the heritage language community by developing understanding of the legacy of university-initiated research, settler colonialism, and the peoples indigenous to the land being occupied, and second, between the heritage language community itself. Complete ideological clarity is unobtainable due to the diversity of speech communities, nor is it the goal. Rather, ideological clarification is needed as a process to ensure that the work of language revitalization is being utilized efficiently to support language learning. Too often, the work of language revitalization movements are consumed in part by conflicting language ideologies that may result in conflicts that serve to stall language maintenance. Grenoble and Whaley mention how many speech communities remain essentially hypothetical due to speakers and language activists choosing the dominant language as the primary mode of communication. However, this choice to speak the dominant language is in part a response to the level of discrimination surrounding a language community, serving as a silencing force. Harrison observes how languages react to such pressure. Many factors can interrupt successful language transmission, but it is rarely the result of free will. The decision tends to be made by the very youngest speaker, 6 to 7 years old, under duress or social pressure, and these children then influence the speech behavior of adults in the community. These youngest speakers, acting as tiny social barometers, are acutely sensitive to the disfavored status of their elders' language, and they may choose to speak the more dominant tongue. The continued discrimination toward a group of people and their language has detrimental effects on language learners, even at the young age of 6. One responsibility of non-heritage language learners is to address the culture of silence surrounding local language communities. Some suggest that this responsibility should specifically work to change the majority attitudes toward a more favorable one in regards to the local language. It would be a naive and even insulting to imply that non-heritage learners are the key somehow to dissipating the silence or changing such attitudes. Indeed, heritage language learning communities vary on the level of inclusion for the non-Indigenous majority. The non-heritage learner must respect the self-determination of local language communities by navigating these boundaries of inclusion in different domains. Albury sees this inclusion or exclusion as a continuum and one that is constantly shifting.
To close, we believe that there is a shared responsibility of the non-heritage language learner to respect boundaries, shift community attitudes, and be reflective in one's own personal role in a language movement. While this is a new area of theoretical and applicable investigation, the hope is that by engaging in a critical discussion with all involved in language revitalization efforts, we can continue to reflect on our shared responsibilities to these languages.
Questions. First of all, I want to really thank you. I really appreciate that you have spoken about this. I'm also a non-native linguist, and I work with the native communities from the place that I'm born from, and I've been like throughout that learning a lot more about the history. Lot to deal with, and it's a lot of the way that I do my work is I know going into it that I'm a white person and all these things. So I was wondering solutions that you two have kind of brewed up while working in this way.
Well, we specifically didn't like give the list of solutions that we've achieved because within each language, it's going to be a different way of, you know, how you carry out that research or language learning. And even within a language, there's going to be different situations. And just basic guidelines is just, you know, you're working with certain speakers, you're working within a language community. While you want to recognize your own background, you also don't want to make that the focus. So just trying to make sure that questions you're asking or clarifications you're looking for or even your research questions are something that the community is asking for or looking for and isn't taking away from the effort that they have going. I'm not sure if that helps, but
no. I've had a somewhat similar experience and I've had a personal interaction that's really made me think about my role. I was fortunate enough learn some Galilara at university, which is an Aboriginal language of New South Wales in Australia, and I was meeting a new colleague for the first time, and I noticed that he had on his arms tattooed the words for mother and father in Galilara, and I said, oh, great, are you Galilara man? Oh, I speak some Galilara. And he then told me a story about how he hadn't had the opportunity to learn any of his heritage language. His cousin had been the language, I guess, expert in his family, and his cousin had recently passed. So it was a sort of a sore topic, and I felt very awkward about the fact that he felt shame about he hadn't taken up the chance to learn language before his cousin had passed. So it was a very awkward situation, and it made me feel very conscious about the way that I approach my knowledge and talking about my knowledge of the language. But on the flip side, I'm aware that it is an extremely endangered language, and it's really made me ponder what is my responsibility to helping this language and working with this language. And I'm interested in your perspectives on, you know, what do you feel are your responsibilities going forward working with Tungut?
I mean, it's a constant struggle between sort of attempting to internalize what I feel like the community has asked me to do, and then also recognizing that the community is not one homogenous mass of people who like do this thing and everyone's in agreement about these sort of things. And so I've had to sort of accept that there are people that I work really closely with who have asked me to, you know, go to graduate school and focus on Tlingit and do, you know, linguistic research and gain those sort of skills and to come back and support the language movement that way. And there are people who may not appreciate that that's the route that I've gone, and those are both perfectly valid opinions, and one is not better than the other. And so I guess I feel like my responsibility is whatever I'm asked to do, and then recognizing that that myself included, as a mixed Indigenous person, a lot of people are coming from places of hurt. And so their sometimes negative comments towards me are not really about me, and attempting not to take that personally. So yeah, my responsibility is whatever they tell me to do, and recognizing that sometimes those are going to be conflicting things, and then sort of just attempting to walk as many lines as possible, I guess, yeah.
You mentioned that part of your, I may have misinterpreted, part of your job as a linguist is to help shift the attitude of the community in reference to language. Like, I come from a community where there is strong opposition to language revitalization in some way, or a lack of understanding of the importance of the language. And so what are some of the things that you do to help address that?
Well,
I mean, I guess, so are you asking if we feel like it's the job of like a linguist or like an outside researcher to change perceptions about if a community doesn't feel like an individual doesn't feel like it's important to revitalize the language? I don't personally feel like that's, I hope that was not the impression that we gave in the paper, because I don't feel like that's personally the role of any outside force. Like, if an individual doesn't feel like it's necessary to revitalize their language, then that's its own personal relationship with the community and its language. And as an outsider, we come in if we're asked, and that's the role I feel like we play. I mean, our responsibility is to change perceptions within our own discipline. So as a linguist, changing perceptions about what language revitalization is and what working with communities are, and then sort of addressing this like historical colonial roots in these academic disciplines, like I feel like that's part of the responsibility of me, I guess. But yeah, trying to change community attitudes, that's a community, yeah. Yeah. And I think one thing that we have talked about too is balancing, taking on a role to help address some of these things, even just talking about Tlingit language in our community, so that it's not just the job of the Tlingit people living there to inform everyone else who largely may not care or may not be informed or may have harmful attitudes about the language in general. So recognizing, taking on some of that responsibility of sharing that information, but also not doing that without the language community by, you know, sharing whatever I want to about it or not following through with what I've been taught, in a sense.
I just want to thank you very much for raising this issue. It's extremely complex and it's emotional on every side, and I want to really express my appreciation for raising it in this context where it's really important. I think many of us deal with that, but the level of respect and compassion and humanitarianism that you're approaching this with, I think is really commendable. Thank you.
I also want to thank you. I am a non-heritage learner and teacher of the Yakima language at the University of Oregon. And as more heritage speakers come into my class, these kinds of conversations for them have been really important in the classroom. And I have to justify to the institution, you know, there's a space, we need space for these conversations. You know, it's not, you know, don't put me down for not having, you know, these activities. This is a part of this work, and it's a part of this language work and these relationships. And so for me, part of the role is hearing from these heritage speakers and fighting at the institution level to make space and to change the research. Because they consider it service to the community rather than research, and you just bringing this up as a theoretical issue. Makes me so happy.